Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee, here on France 24, live every Friday, discussing the most significant global events of the past 7 days with four distinguished international correspondents. In a week that the war in Gaza appeared to get closer to a 60-day truce, and a week that's seen a corruption trial facing Benjamin Netanyahu postponed by an Israeli court coming hours after President Trump took to social media, claiming the case was a witch hunt and would interfere with the Israeli Prime Minister's urgent diplomacy to negotiate a deal. While diplomats talked up the chance for a ceasefire, Israeli fighter jets significantly increased their missile fire across the Strip. Since Saturday, at least 300 Palestinians have died, according to the Hamas-run health authorities, with a beachside cafe that's been seen as a rare place for respite destroyed, with dozens there killed. Israel says Hamas militants were the target. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese, delivered one of the most damning assessments of Israeli actions in the conflict so far, repeating her stance that a genocide is taking place, which Israel vehemently denies. And going further too, the independent expert appointed by the UN to investigate human rights issues labelled global companies who deal with Israel as complicit, called the sole provider of aid, the Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, nothing but a death trap.
There is no possibility to stepping out of this situation other than for member states to do what the International Court of Justice demands through its ruling and through its provisional measures, imposing an arms embargo immediately. It's not about asking for a ceasefire. This is not a war. This is a genocidal campaign. And it's clear, and now it's either carried out under the pretense of humanitarian food distribution. This is a death trap. And we should learn really to be honest, including yourself. I mean, I've been really, really generous to the media, because the first corporate entity to be investigated in this mandate was yours, and it will come.
The US government is calling for her to be dismissed, calling her anti-Semitic. We'll get to that in a moment. And more stateside on Independence Day, as President Trump signs his self-titled One Big Beautiful Bill, with critics calling him a reverse Robin Hood. We look too at what's behind the sentencing of the French-Algerian writer Boualem Sansal in Algiers. And also, we're going to look at a year of Keir Starmer in the House of Commons this week, a week of tears behind the dispatch box, and MPs revolting. We'll get to that coming up on France 24. First, let's meet the panel this week. I mentioned four correspondents who are with us this week. Let's first of all bring in the first of them. Let's bring in Paul Moreau. Great to see you on the programme, Paul.
Thank you for inviting me.
An interesting week for you. Your production company, Premier Linea, you've been looking at many documentaries over the years, behind many, including those on Russia too, on Putin, on the information war machines. Let me ask you what you've made of this call this week, President Putin speaking, President Macron, for the first time in 3 years, whether you think the French president achieved anything by it.
He achieved to communicate the call with Putin. I'm afraid that's the main goal of this call, to make it clear that he plays a role in the international arena. But I don't see it going further than that, really.
And as you came in tonight, you said you're in the middle of finishing three documentaries at the same time. Talk me through some of them.
Well, there is a series for France Télévisions about the opioid crisis. I had access to the industry people who took care of poisoning hundreds of thousands of Americans, like people from the Purdue Pharma, INSIS, labs like that. And I also went to Mexico to meet the narcos and have their take about it.
When can we see them?
In October on France Télévisions.
Fantastic. Paul Moreau, great to have you with us. Also joining us tonight, Emma Kate Simmons, a Paris-based writer, correspondent, contributor to the New European, Franc Tireur, an English sharpshooter, as well as the Conspiracy Watch website set up to debunk fake news. Emma, evening. Great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Talk us through what you've been working on in recent days.
Actually, quite a lot on Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Trump's health secretary, who has really gone full-on anti-vax. Like, he's drunk on the power that Trump has given him, apparently. And he was on Tucker Carlson's program this week, claiming again the debunked links between autism and vaccines, that Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was the chief doctor during COVID in the US, caused COVID. He's fired the 17 expert members of the vaccine committee. He's spreading lies that are being spread during a measles outbreak. So, and it's he's a very committed conspiracy theorist, and now there's no shame surrounding it. He's completely unabashed. He's gone back on everything he said during his confirmation hearings.
How much is Robert F. Kennedy? How much does he have the ear of President Trump? I remember right at the start, President Trump saying, "We'll let him do his thing," but there was a sense that he was an ideal person to bring in voters, but not necessarily ideal eye to eye with what President Trump sees.
No, I think it was a marriage of mutual self-interest. But now Trump has just given him absolute leeway. And the decision that he took to rip out US funding from the Global Vaccine Alliance, Gavi, could literally put millions of children in danger, endanger their lives. And this was a very political decision that needed the State Department to approve. It wasn't just something from the Health Department. So you can see the extent to which Kennedy Jr. has been given a huge mandate, and he's doing what he wants. And Trump likes nothing better than a really disturbing conspiracy theory.
Clearly. And right now, very easy to go under the radar. Emma, great to have you on the programme with us tonight. Let's cross to Jerusalem. Let's bring in Anshul Pfeffer, The Economist, Israel correspondent. Evening, Anshul. Author, Anshul, too, of the critically acclaimed biography, Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the soon-to-be-released No King in Israel, The Jewish State Confronts Its Demons. Anshul, great that you're with us tonight. Tell us a little bit about your new book, where it takes us, and also how you keep on top of such a incredibly, vastly shifting subject, especially just in the past 2 weeks.
Well, that's the issue. I can't tell you where the book is going to take us, because I don't yet know where it ends. The book was originally supposed to be published this summer, but the war has continued. The wars, I mean, we've now had last October, we had the war in Lebanon, and we've had now a 12-day war with Iran. So this story is constantly evolving, and it's evolving across two American administrations as well. We've seen how the arrival of Donald Trump back in the White House has also changed so much in the conflict happening here. So where the book is going to lead, we'll see where the wars and the various political campaigns here are going to lead, and hopefully there'll be a book out by next summer.
And I think I'm right in saying Anshul, Mancunian born, Manchester born, and to which there's some rare sort of music news of takes us away from Israel in the Middle East, which is the Oasis Gallagher Brothers playing for the first time back after 16 years tonight in Cardiff. Would you want to be there amongst those watching the band?
No, they're City supporters. They're not for me.
It's the wrong side, the wrong colour. They're blue. Great to have you with us, Anshul.
Not Manchester.
Anshul, we will find out very shortly then. From London, Patrick Smith, editor-in-chief of the Africa Report magazine and online site. Back with us, Patrick. Great to have you, as always.
Greetings.
You've written extensively on African affairs and politics since the 80s. To the point about reporting on impartiality, while we were on air this time last week, in the midst of anti-government protests in Kenya were kicking off, the Kenyan government issued a directive for broadcasters to stop live broadcasts of the demonstrations. Talk us through what was going on there.
Well, it was a year anniversary, actually, of the mass national demonstrations that rocked Kenya in protest of a bill that was going to hike taxes right across the society. And 34 out of the 47 counties in the country, as a population of about 60 million people, went out on the streets. That's a year ago. Many of them clashed with the police. And about 60 protesters were gunned down. So this was a demonstration organised last week to commemorate the lives of those who have lost, who lost their lives, and then to bring in a new spirit of protest, because the government is still trying to push through another budget with punitive consequences for Kenyans. So in the midst of those demonstrations, the police opened fire on in a couple of sites around Nairobi, and then the order came for all the big TV stations in Kenya to stop live broadcasts. But, you know, in the age of social media, that's pretty irrelevant because everyone was filming and broadcasting on their social media platforms. And Kenya is one of the most connected societies in Africa when it comes to IT, telecoms, you name it. They invented mobile money virtually. So the government's edict didn't have the desired effect from the government's point of view. And this footage came out with the Kenyan police gunning down unarmed demonstrators, and that sends a pretty chilling message about the state of politics and the state of governance in the country at the moment.
You remind me of, just on the issue of the power of social media, the ban NICAP, banned from BBC coverage live at Glastonbury this week, pro-Palestinian ban from the north of Ireland, to which on TikTok they had more than 1 million viewers watching it live. So people are watching these things elsewhere. Patrick, briefly, I wanted to ask your thoughts on Simon Mann, who died a few weeks ago. You were the associate producer, Patrick.
Yes.
The critically acclaimed documentary, weren't you? My Friend the Mercenary, about the Wonga coup in Equatorial Guinea. Simon was the key figure, ex-British SAA officer, SAS, and mercenary. His story was extraordinary, wasn't it?
It was. It was like a sort of typical British boy's own adventure. You know, you have this public school boy, then joins the British forces, the Special Forces, the Special Air Services Group, and then fights in Northern Ireland, fights in Lebanon at one stage, and then goes private and sets up his own mercenary company. We saw the results of that in this failed coup in Equatorial Guinea. But the whole coup had a kind of Keystone Cops element to it. These guys had a company set up to take over the oil assets. They promised a group of Equatorial Guinea opposition politicians, you know, you can be president, you can be oil minister, I just need a cut of the assets and all the rest of it. And the whole thing collapsed when Mann and his compatriots were arrested along with some South African mercenaries. And unfortunately for him, I guess that it was the event in his life for which he will be remembered, this failed coup. But it's also, I think, part of the end of an era of sort of British colonial fantasies, in a way.
Adventurism. Patrick, great to have you with us. Let's begin at Monday. It was 12 minutes to 3 in the afternoon that the beachside Al Baka Cafe, a rare place of respite in Gaza, was hit by an Israeli airstrike. One of the few places that remained for ordinary Palestinians that had reliable internet, where you could charge your phone. It had become a hub for journalists, activists, aid workers and locals. At least 24 people were killed. For some of them, we can put a face to a name because the work they did was on camera. The Israeli military says it was, quote, targeting Hamas terrorists, but not much more information since. Ismail Abu Hattab was a 34-year-old Palestinian photographer and filmmaker who had his work featured in LA, an exhibition of his curated work from Gaza. It was called Between the Sky and the Sea. Now, Ismail also filmed these scenes that we can see from the cafe. This was the view from the cafe in the days before it was hit. We can take a look at the footage that Ismail took. Told local journalists that with his death, more than just one set of eyes had closed. There was also a well-known young amateur boxer, Malek Musli, who was meeting a friend on Monday. She'd been filmed training by the cafe during COVID by Chinese state TV on life in Gaza. Here she is talking about her dreams.
معروفة هذه اللعبة إنه بس للأولاد ولكن لما أنا خشيت هذا المجال حبيتها وأعطتني طاقة إيجابية كتير منيحة فيعني عادي ممكن بنات وولاد يلعبوها وأنا إن شاء الله رح أكمل فيها لحد ما أكبر وأمثل عالم فلسطيني إن شاء الله ومش رح أبع يعني مش رح أفصل منها.
Well, 300 people were reportedly killed in the territory this week as strikes intensified, including the director of the Indonesia hospital, Dr. Marwan Al Sultan, along with his wife and children, while his apartment was hit. Israel said it struck a key terrorist, and an investigation is ongoing into, quote, uninvolved civilians who were harmed. This happening in a week that a ceasefire of 60 days is said to be near, one that could see Hamas return some of the estimated 50 Israeli hostages, both alive and dead, who are still held in Gaza. Let's begin in Jerusalem with Anshel. Anshel, how do you read the situation? President Trump saying within 24 hours we could have news of a ceasefire.
Well, Donald Trump has saw last week how just a couple of phone calls and some posts on social media ended the war in Iran. And I think now he expects to do the same in Gaza. Now, it's not so simple to do that in Gaza. The war's been going now for 21 months, and he's just the second American president to try and somehow end it. I think that now, finally, we can, with very guarded optimism, say that there does seem to be a chance that it's happening. Israel has accepted the American proposal. The American proposal is not that different from the previous ceasefire that was accepted in January, but Israel, in the second phase of that ceasefire, returned to fighting. This time, Trump has given what we're not quite clear the nature of these guarantees, but he's given guarantees through the Qatari brokers to Hamas that this time he will insist on the ceasefire holding. It's still initially a 60-day ceasefire, but then there is a chance that there'll be additional talks, and that will somehow lead to a more lasting ceasefire. In public, Netanyahu is still saying that he's not accepting an end to the war, but in private, I am hearing from some of his advisors that I think this time there is a chance that it will lead to an end to the war.
I was speaking, Anshel, to Oliver McTernan from Forward Thinking, a former mediator who said he spoke to some of the mediators with Hamas in the past few days, and the way they're presenting it to him is that this was a package put forward by Trump that was an Israeli package that he's repackaged and said, you know, this is the final proposal, and that the sense is that, well, as he saw it, there's very little information on what's in the deal so far because there's been so few leaks. Do you know what's in the deal in terms of how many hostages could be released, more than kind of beyond the 60 days?
Well, in the last couple of hours, there have been a couple of reports which purport to be the deal. And I think from what I know, they seem to be quite accurate. As far as the hostages are concerned, 8 live hostages will be released on the very first day of the deal, and 2 more on day 50. And that's sort of to keep Israel focused on the negotiations. And there are a number of bodies of hostages will be released in between those two dates. There'll be 125 Palestinian prisoners, which Israel regards as those with blood on their hands who have been convicted of murder. They will be released in return, and an additional 1,000 plus Palestinian prisoners who were captured during the last 21 months during this war. So that part does seem to be pretty clear. And really, the main issue here is what will be the timetable of an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza? Will Israel withdraw from the entire territory? And will there be, at the end of this 60-day period, a full ceasefire? Will we transition from what is essentially a truce, not a ceasefire, into an actual ceasefire? And that, for Israelis, is the main issue, because Hamas will still be standing, even though it's very weakened, even though it's diminished. Most of its leadership has been killed. 20,000 or so of its fighters have been killed in this war. But that is still, for many Israelis at least, a concession that Hamas is still in charge of parts of Gaza. I have to say that a majority of Israelis now, in every poll conducted for months now, 60-odd percent of Israelis are in favor of accepting this deal. The problem is that the 30% of Israelis who are against this deal are very heavily represented in the Netanyahu government.
Paul, listening to Anshel's points, I just wonder about what you make of whether we're seeing a bounce effect, whether because of, and we heard Anshel mention at the start, the calls that Trump had made, the differences we saw from Iran and the ceasefire in place, whether it's having a rollover effect and it's kind of re-energising the calls for this truce.
The thing is, like he said, in the first ceasefire plan, there was the idea that the Israelis were about, they should have withdrawn at phase two, and they didn't, and they weren't intending to. I mean, it was Netanyahu made very clear that, okay, he had negotiated that, but changed his mind, and he won't withdraw. So I don't think that we will see in the near future a withdrawal of the Israeli troops from Gaza. I mean, repeatedly they have said that they're here to stay, that they want to implement, that's not official, but that's what you hear in the media repeatedly, that they want to implement the Trump-Riviera plan. And I believe that, there's probably going to be some hostages freed, and that's great. And there's probably going to be some recede of the firing, of the killings, which is great. By the way, I want to thank you to show the faces of the people who got killed, because it's so dehumanizing what has happened for the last 2 years, where you never see a face, you never have a name on the people who die. And I think it's really unbearable. And it's really bravo, Franz Van Gaat, to show faces and say that there are lives between behind the death. So I think it's always good that people speak about a ceasefire, but I don't foresee an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, which would be a precondition to peace coming back to the area soon.
Well, it also speaks, just listening to the friend of Ismail Abu Hattab, saying that when his eyes close, so do the eyes of others. Because, let's face it, the point is, Emma Kate, that there aren't any journalists allowed in there. So everything we hear, whether it's the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, we hear with a lack of ability to verify what's going on. And I wonder what you make of, probably we heard at the top of the programme, the strongest statement yet from Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur, and naming businesses too, like Volvo, BNP Paribas, banks, IBM, Amazon, that are dealing with Israel.
Right. Well, I would say that I think that we should preface that report with a statement about Francesca Albanese's history and the way she's currently. She's been condemned vociferously by the French, German, United States governments for a long time for her long history of very anti-Semitic comments, of Nazifying Israel and Jews, and of spreading conspiracy theories, even about Charlie Hebdo attacks. So I'm unfortunately in this crisis, there's so many not particularly objective or good actors. I would quote for you from the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt. He said that the report that she published wasn't a human rights analysis, but a blatant effort to economically isolate Israel. And she's open about that, and we understand the position she's coming from. But she goes so far with some of these companies which have investments in pension funds that might have links to or investments in Israel. So that's one position, right? But her position has always been pretty much opposition to the existence of the state of Israel. It's not just about this conflict. So, but that
and
doesn't.
It's worth saying she's in a powerful position.
She's extremely contentious, and she was opposed in that position by several governments that I already listed. But you can then go to a person from the Israeli left, Fania Oz Salzberger, who's the daughter of Amos Oz, and she said that, you know, this week she said again on a personal note, "I'm devastated by Israel's documented crimes in Gaza and by many of my fellow Israelis' tendencies to deny such crimes." And she did go on to say that there is, however, in her view, a collective trauma, obviously based around what happened on October 7 of this horrible terrorist attack, pogrom, so many people murdered, and the hostage crisis that hasn't been resolved. And the fact, as Anshel pointed out, most Israelis want this war to be finished, and they want a ceasefire to be negotiated, and they want those hostages home and the body's home. So I just think, once again, the polarization we see on this, and it's so hard to get, as you say, clear information. I mean, but that's not to deny that there evidently there have been horrible killings, including of civilians, and some Israeli soldiers have spoken out about that in reports that were in Haaretz newspaper that were fiercely contested by the Israeli government. But there's now an inquiry, right, Anshel? An official inquiry has been opened after these reports into whether or not the IDF was ordered to shoot.
Well, there's two things, Anshel, to mention to you. I want to bring Patrick in as well. First of all, Israel calling this report from the UN Special Rapporteur, quote, groundless, flagrant abuse of office. The US saying she's anti-Semitic. Anshel, just to the point of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and its controversy, we're hearing a piece in the BBC today with a former employee who's been disregarded as far as the GHF, but he's said that he overheard conversations in which there were people were spoken of, Palestinians, of as zombies, that they were not given kind of humanitarian treatment. What's your sense of the controversy first of all, Anshel,
The GHF is an organization which was kind of thrown together very quickly under rather suspicious circumstances. This BBC report that you're mentioning is about the American contractors who were working in these distribution hubs of the GHF. And I think Patrick, as someone who's written a lot about mercenaries, knows very well that type of person. It's they're called defense contractors nowadays, but we used to be called mercenaries in the media. And about Mrs. Albanese, I have to disagree. I'm sorry, with Kate. I agree with most of what she said, but I don't think she's in a powerful position. I think that the whole title of the United Nations Special Rapporteur is a rather ambiguous title. It's not. It's a position with absolutely no power, no authority. These are people who are appointed by the UN Human Rights Commission, which doesn't really have any power. It's not like the Security Council, and they're supposed to be the Special Rapporteur is supposed to have expertise in kind of obscure, overlooked fields of human rights, of conflicts that are not covered sufficiently, or supposed to have real special knowledge about some of these things. And I think in this case, we're not talking about a conflict which is overlooked. We're talking about a conflict which is reported to a very, very major degree. And Ms. Albanese doesn't seem to bring any kind of knowledge or special expertise to it, and basically she's parroting stuff that she reads in the media or various activist positions, and she has zero influence. So I don't really understand why we have to be discussing what she says. She has a title, but it's a meaningless title. So I think it's more important to talk about what's actually happening on the ground than what some Italian lawyer who happens to have a title from a UN agency has to say.
It's very interesting, and I guess it goes back to that point, doesn't it, Anshel, also that if you're going to try to verify what's going on the ground, it's having to be there. And Patrick, Anshel has said, you've looked in the world of mercenaries for a long time and private contractors now. What are you making of the GHF controversy?
Anshel's expertise obviously is on top of this story. I think there are a lot of questions as to why this organization was even needed. A figure I saw, and I think it may have been in The Economist or The New York Times, 500 people have been killed in queuing for food distributed from this hub. So the whole point of setting up this organization in the first place was meant to be to provide security for food distribution in Gaza. That hasn't worked, evidently. It's a blatant tragedy. And of course, then you've got the overall situation of the deprivation of food, medicaments, and so forth from the civilian population there. So I suppose that does reinforce the pressure for some sort of ceasefire agreement. I have to say, I don't agree with Anshel about this. There's not a huge amount of international pressure on behind this at all. It seems to be very much a bilateral negotiation between Trump and Netanyahu, with the Qataris trying to offering some sort of compromise that will get Hamas to sign up. But it really doesn't look like it's a definitive end or even a definitive pause to the conflict. I think it's worth making that point. Mm. 21 months of this conflict, yet the conflicts in southern Lebanon and the conflict with Iran over nuclear weapons were over in a matter of days. And it seems unconscionable that this conflict is dragging out. And it does raise everyone's suspicions that for Netanyahu, this is an incredibly convenient politically for him. If the war in Gaza finished, what happens to his own electoral position?
Anshel, to round up to where we are now, to Patrick's point as well, where this goes to, am I right, to the Hamas political leadership? They want a guarantee, as you pointed to earlier, that they won't be targeted by Israel. So there's a question about troops. But they've said before they haven't, I think about a year ago, they were prepared to transfer to civilian control to a technocratic body. And I guess there's a question about whether they're prepared to pass the running of the strip politically to a technocratic Palestinian body as well.
here, both Hamas and the Netanyahu government have their political considerations. Hamas want to have some kind of control over what happens in Gaza, whether they will remain openly in control or they'll be behind, or they'll be one of the powers behind this technocratic government. And Netanyahu has his own local considerations of when there'll be an election in Israel and whether the election will be a reckoning with his failure to anticipate and to act and to prevent the Hamas surprise attack on October 7. We've seen in the polls in Israel how much that's damaged his standing. So Netanyahu has been trying to somehow postpone the election as far as he can, but there's a limit to how far he could postpone that anyway. And now we have the element of Donald Trump wanting to impose a ceasefire because that Trump wants that mantle of the peacemaker. It hasn't worked with Russia-Ukraine. It's worked better in ending the war very quickly with Iran. And now he wants to do it with Gaza. Netanyahu wants Trump's support during his election campaign. So that's why I think there is a better chance now that both Israel and Hamas are under a lot of pressure from the Qataris. I think there's a better chance they will reach some kind of an agreement in the next few days.
OK, well, President Trump saying 24 hours we may have an answer to the US. A week of record-breaking political drama, precision planned choreography, which sees this week culminate with President Trump signing what he calls his one big beautiful bill in a White House ceremony on the day of celebration for America's Independence Day. I say record-breaking because it took an unprecedented 26 hours to be voted on in the Senate. Three Republicans voted against their president, with one-time Trump BFF ex-Doge boss Elon Musk threatening Republicans who didn't vote for it that he would make their lives miserable in the midterms, that if the bill passed, he'd set up a third party called the America Party. And once Trump got wind, he was asked by reporters, "Are you going to deport Elon Musk?"
I don't know. I think we'll have to take a look. We might have to put Doge on Elon. You know what Doge is? Doge is the monster that might have to go back and eat Elon. Wouldn't that be terrible?
Elon aside, the bill went through the Senate with Veep, J.D. Vance having the casting vote. The House of Representatives agreed on the changes, including not calling the bill big or beautiful, but the America First bill. It's estimated it will add over $3 trillion to national debt over 10 years. It contains vast cuts, coupled with cuts to health insurance coverage. It will impact millions of Americans and increase spending to border security, defence, energy production. Let's begin with Emma Cates, a record-breaking week in terms of the amount of time this took. What do you think the schisms and the ripple effect has been of what this bill has created?
Well, there's almost no schisms. There was a kind of pretend phony war just before, and eventually nearly all Republicans bowed down before the king and voted for the big, beautiful bill, which is what they called it for so long. But in the end, they're going to pay for that at the next elections if they are free and fair, because so many MAGA voters, including in red states, don't realise that the cuts to Medicaid, which is health insurance for poor and older Americans and disabled Americans, actually falls into a lot of other insurance categories. So people are already going to see this incredible impact. And obviously, what Musk has correctly pointed out, the absolute blowing out of the deficit. I mean, the increase in funding to ICE, which is, you know, conducting these fascistic immigration crackdowns, has gone from $3.4 billion to $45 billion at the end of 2029. So there's a creation, as 20 Catholic bishops wrote a letter condemning this bill, in particular that creation of a kind of deportation industrial complex. So in the short term, it's another win for Donald Trump, who can't seem to stop raking them in. And he has been able to get away with the fact that he has ripped out munitions being sent to Ukraine and lifted sanctions on Russia, which was just condemned in an editorial by the New York Post, which is, you know, a Rupert Murdoch-owned, normally long-time pro-Trump.
So that would be classed as friendly fire, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So I think, at the same time, he's been allowed to get away with that, more focused on this bill, the fight with Musk. But Musk is a threat to him because Musk has the kind of money that he showed he could use to help elect Trump this second time around. So if he uses it at the next election and he's being hurt on his electric vehicles, let's see. Not really a schism.
Not really a schism yet. Well, it's at least we're hearing Elon Musk, Paul, saying he's going to set up his own, or he's threatening to set up the America Party. I spoke to Elon's dad recently, Errol Musk, who said that This is when they first had their split a few weeks ago. He said he's not interested in a political party. That's a bit further down the line. It may not be the case. But he did say to me, if there was a bust-up between the world's most powerful man and the world's richest, he believed every time the world's most powerful man would win.
Well, obviously, the facts speak for themselves. Trump has been winning repeatedly against Musk because Musk is no longer in the White House. He's no longer promoting his cars on the lawn of the White House. That was the best segment of his presence in the White House, I thought.
That he paid full price for as well.
Absolutely. Yeah? No, but it was a surrealistic moment where Trump was selling the cars of his good friend. And nevertheless, it's really interesting what's happening with those guys of the tech authoritarians. You can see the surge of an ideology that is definitely the new face of fascism. Musk is part of it. Peter Thiel is part of it. Curtis Yarvin is part of it. And this is something where they want to deprive the people out of democracy. They don't believe in democracy anymore. They think that technology can control people. They have sold like Palantir. We know I've been used repeatedly to kill people in Gaza, to identify people by their likes on Facebook and social networks, to kill them. So this is the new crowd that is bearing a political project. And Musk is one of them. And they won't be out of the picture after 27. And I believe Trump may be out of the picture and Vance may replace him in 27. And he's good friends with them.
To your point, and also, Patrick, just listening to Emma Kate's point, I think she got to the heart of it a moment ago, which is the divisions. Emma Kate said not schisms, but I think the divisions in terms of the choice that had to be made amongst Republicans. This is an Alaskan senator. I don't know if you saw this week. This is Lisa Murkowski. Played a pivotal role. If four senators went against Trump, the bill was lost. Three did. And even though she didn't like the bill at all, she said she secured tax breaks for Alaska for the whaling industry. This is her conversation. This is her stare-off with reporter Ryan Neal after the vote.
That your vote was a bailout for Alaska at the expense of the rest of the country.
Oh, my God.
That's what Senator Paul said.
Senator, we've got the...
I didn't say it, ma'am. I'm just asking for your response.
My response is I have an obligation to the people of the state of Alaska. And I live up to that every single day. I fight for my state's interests, and I make sure that Alaskans are understood.
Patrick, does that 12-second stare point to what Elon Musk this week called pork barrel politics, giving favours for the sake of a short-term win?
Yeah, I have to say I don't often agree with him about American politics or any other kind of politics, but I would say he's dead right on this. It is back to the pork barrel-style politics. And that, I guess, is the swelling of all these special interests being represented state by state in the union, and that's why it's so massive. I mean, you're ending up with a debt to GDP ratio of 106%, which I write a lot about developing country debt. And if you go anywhere near that, the IMF issue a very, very stern warning that you're bankrupting the country. The $3 trillion spending, you are sounding alarms, not just about where the economy is today, but the legacy that this administration in the US is going to be leaving for the next generation. I think one estimate I saw is that you're going to be needing to raise revenue by over 5% within 10 years, over a 10-year period, 5% a year. So you're storing up a lot of trouble at a time when the US dollar is certainly willfully, it seems to be falling against other currencies and raising concerns there, and also sort of holding up the concern about do people really want to lend the US money? So despite all this stream of foreign leaders going to see Trump and negotiate special tariff deals, That's not being reflected in the international markets by the professionals who are taking a view on US Treasury bills and looking around for alternative assets to invest. That seems to be sending some very, very dangerous signals about the US economy for the short term and indeed the medium term.
But other indicators are good. I mean, paradoxically, yes, it's true. Obviously, the US dollar, very grim. It's lost 10% at least of its value since Trump was inaugurated. But inflation is not as high as it expected. The jobs figures that came in this week were better than expected. Mm-hmm. Unemployment's at 4.1%, I think. So I think from an America First perspective, if Americans aren't traveling and don't realize the impact of the lower dollar, which was always apparently a strategy of Trump's, you know, they feel okay. And the stock market is surging, the S&P 500. So the kinds of losses we saw after the Liberation Day announcement of Trump's tariffs are not affecting domestic markets that, you know, shares in the United States. But it's true that foreign investors and treasury holdings, certainly there's a huge impact there.
Well, let's move to that point, 7,000 kilometres east of Washington. Let's go to Algiers. On Tuesday morning, news coming through from the Court of Appeal that a judge had decided to uphold the 5-year jail sentence in the case of the French-Algerian writer Boualem Sansal, convicted of undermining national unity under the country's anti-terrorism laws. The 80-year-old author, renowned in France for a fearless critique of political oppression. He's focused themes of totalitarianism, been a vocal critic of Islamic fundamentalism and Algerian government too. Here he is on France 24 last year talking about writing and the importance to him of not changing the names of real figures that he's focused on.
In Algeria, my books were censored because they were full frontal attacks on power. I named names. I didn't use any aliases. I named them, Mr. Bouteflika, Mr. Boumedine, and so on. And I treated Islamism the same way. So, of course, I made a lot of enemies.
Now, the charges appear to stem from statements Boualem made in an interview. In October 2024, the right-wing French media outlet Frontier, he argued that during the French colonial period, Algeria's borders were redrawn that includes territory that historically belonged to Morocco and referenced the contested region of Western Sahara. He was arrested at Algiers airport a month later, has been widely condemned that decision by Algerian police, by human rights groups for being politically motivated. And before the arrest, President Macron explicitly recognised Western Sahara region as Moroccan, which exacerbated diplomatic fallout between the two countries. Let's stop, Paul, with Boualem here in France. His place in the literary world, how highly is he regarded?
No, he's a great writer and he has to go out of jail now, tomorrow. I want to tell you a story about Algeria. In 2020, we did a documentary, not officially, it was an undercover documentary because you cannot work freely. That we must say also that there's a journalist, a French journalist, who has been sentenced to 7 years in jail, Christophe Gilles, and he has to be let out also. And so we do this documentary. We send an Algerian journalist, you know, eight times. He works the way he can work, you know, and he comes out with a he really loves this country. The name of the documentary is Algérie, mon amour, Algeria, my love. But he talks a lot about Iraq. He talks a lot about the kids that have sexual problems. They cannot meet. They cannot have sex. I mean, you know, petty things, but that makes the day-to-day life. When the documentary came out, Algeria called back their ambassador.
Wow.
And they issued a statement where they said that, I don't have the exact phrasing, but more or less what he was saying, it was that it's the old plot of the French colonials against the independence of Algeria. So there was like this, you know, bulk of paranoia in the middle of the statement. And I must say that it never went away in the relationship between this colonial fact that it's true, the way the French waged the war in Algeria gave reasons to stay paranoid after. It was a very dirty war. But it's interesting to see that this has never been cleaned up or has never been taken. One of my first works as a young journalist was to interview during 6 months guys who had been French soldiers in the Algerian war. I would go through scenes where people would tell me their wars with horrible scenes, and they tell me, it's the first time we talk about our war. So France has denied what has happened between Algeria and France. Remember, the fact that we can say the war is very recent. It has like 10 years only before it was the events. So there's this whole French thing of the denial carpet, you know, that doesn't help the relationship to heal between the two countries.
Right, except Sonsal's imprisonment is much more to do with this Algerian civil war in the 1990s when hundreds of thousands were attacked or killed by Islamists. I mean, you know, he's spoken out against, and there's this power play between hardliners in the Algerian regime and those who were hoping today. I read that there was hope that there would be presidential amnesty given to Sonsal today, and 6,500 youngsters have apparently been given amnesty, can leave prison, but not him. So, as you say, it's got caught up in an ideological warfare, which makes references back to colonialism, but also this sort of less spoken about period of Algerian history that also affects other writers. There's lesser known writers, and you mentioned the football writer, and he's in prison basically because he went to do a report about the Kabyle Berber minority, and essentially that's what's behind that. So there's all kinds of political agendas in this repression.
Yeah, this is 34-year-old Christophe Glizès. You talked about he was allegedly affiliated, he's the president of the football club, was allegedly affiliated with an Algerian separatist group classed by the government as a terrorist organisation, the French government calling for his release and calling, as you said before, for clemency in the case of Boualem Sansal. Patrick, just on the case of Sansal, what is the Algerian, as you understand it, political position in terms of the likelihood of him and Christophe being released anytime soon?
You'd have thought, as was said, that they may choose the timing of Algeria's Independence Day to release him, but it seems that's not going to happen. I think the power behind this this decision is partly reflects the President Tebboune's paranoia about being the man, being the leader who lost the argument over Western Sahara, given that now you've seen this pattern of countries across the world led by France and Spain, now Britain following up, buying into Morocco's regional autonomy plan for the Western Sahara, and indeed other African states like Ghana and Kenya, a lot of pressure now on South Africa to follow suit as well. This would be an incredible political loss for Tebboune. And so that is why I think the Sansal case has taken on its another dimension, which is nothing to do with his writing. He's a brilliant writer. So is Kamel Daoud, by the way, who has also been persecuted by the Algerian state. Worth mentioning him, I think. But it's to do with the power politics. And this is one of the fiercest disputes in Africa at the moment between Morocco and Algeria. And you know, Algeria could not really afford diplomatically to lose this. And I think he's seen as a kind of water carrier for the Moroccans. Quite wrong. It's not what he was saying at all. Yes. He was pointing out to some of a colonial injustice in a way. But it's been deliberately misinterpreted by le pouvoir in Algiers.
Patrick, great to have your thought on that. Thank you to all the panellists this evening, this week, live in London, joined by Patrick Smith, Editor-in-Chief of The Africa Report. From Jerusalem, Anshul Pfeffer, The Economist, Israel correspondent and author. With me in the studio, Emma-Kate Simmons, journalist, contributor to The New European, and Frank Thierreur, and documentary filmmaker at Premier Linea, Paul Moreira. Thank you all. Thank you for watching. We will see you in 7 days for The World next week.